Well, hi and welcome. I appreciate the kind words and responses you've sent and the emails in response to the question and to our initial seminar. I welcome any input, suggestions, and things that you'd like to be sure we include. And I promise you I'll work into our discussion responses to the couple of questions that I had. I've seen a couple of interesting things. One, a book cover that looks terrific that I believe was AI assisted, which is a great way to think about it. One app that I have used myself that I find useful is Grammarly, Grammerly. It's free. There's also a $99 version that does some additional stuff like check for unconscious plagiarism and things like that. So it's a very useful thing. It's work, but it's useful for some initial things that you may want to put much more thought in and care into. Any responses, questions, or feedback at this point, or additional things you'd like to be sure we cover as we talk this seminar about the craft of writing? Anyone? Well, you'll notice the seminars correspond to the four components of the workbook, and I'd suggest that you look at the exercises, the work tools in the workbook that you downloaded with the outline, with the material that you got from when you registered, or from the link that that I sent out. When you do some of the exercises and work tools, it may be helpful to really put it into action and to synthesize it into what you're doing. You may just want to pick one or two that might be useful to you to really crystallize an idea or a way of processing things. Anything you want to add or ask before we launch into our discussion? I'll put us on lecture mode then, so you don't have to worry about the background noise. We're going to talk about the craft of writing. You learn something by doing it. Writing is really not different than that. You learn to write by producing a certain number of words on a regular basis. You learn to become an author by rewriting. And you'll see in the quote, one of the most apropos quotes here from Mark Twain, writing's easy. All you have to do is cross out the wrong words. So you are the author of your life story and your written story. Some reflections as we talk about the craft of writing. And perhaps jot down just a single word or phrase immediately when I ask the question. What do you do uniquely well? First word or phrase, who is your audience? As you think about setting your writing goals, be clear about three things. What your readers need from you. What you want to offer them, and what things you understand that you particularly want to convey to the reader. So let's look first at a dozen motivations and counting for publishing. People want to write for a lot of different reasons, and here's a list of some. To disseminate your knowledge, experience, and message to readers. As a gift to clients, as a premium with some other offer, like an ebook as a bonus for subscribing to a program or a blog or any other product that you have. to publish with a traditional house using an agent to establish a national presence as an author. And we'll talk about the number of different ways to publish. That's only one. To make money by selling the book yourself. To use your book to make money for other services and products, kind of like a business card on steroids. To establish yourself as an expert. To enhance your client base. As a springboard for seminars, workshops, presentations, retreats. To develop mastermind groups or discussion groups based on your book. To make a difference in people's lives. In our own small way, we each want to change the world. Admit it. Here's a quote by Tom Stoppard, one of my favorite playwrights. Words are sacred. They deserve respect. If you get the right ones in the right order, you can nudge the world a little bit. 12, to leave a legacy. Here's how the dedication of one book, it was a memoir on parenting, sounds. To Ryan and Lauren, I hope there will be a time when you find at least some of this book interesting, though if I've done a good job of parenting, not revealing anything new. I don't know whether or if it will be tomorrow or a dozen years of tomorrows from now. Know that whenever it is, I will be loving you. May you walk through all your days with love remembered and love renewed. Dad. That's from Making Memories. Reflections on Parenting from the Heart of a Father and the Mind of a Psychoanalyst. I'm going to use it later as an example of one publishing option. It's the only book I've self-published at this point. Let's talk a little bit about voice. Definite voice is conversational voice. The writer gives us a sense that we're listening to an empathic and interesting storyteller, a skilled raconteur, rather than simply looking at words on paper. Now, think about how different this is from following the simple advice, write the way you talk. Voice involves more than accurate transcription. A true essence of conversation comes from attentive listening and dedicated revision, an empathic resonance with your audience to know what their struggles, their issues, their needs are. Transcribing talk is not writing, but it can be one technique to help cultivate voice and a very easy way of doing an initial draft. I know these things quite well. Some writers speak into recording devices to let their voices flow, to hear themselves at the same time, and simply to envision an intended audience. So one step, let's look at the other end. In your editing process, maybe to read your words out loud, then you can hear how it may sound, not just reading it to yourself. Now, here are a couple of examples of some of my favorite authors, and I want you just to listen to the voice. How you can, in the first one, I think you can know more about the mind and soul of this man than many of you know about your best friends and acquaintances. I used this as a preface in my last book as a psychoanalyst back in the day, Integrating Body, Self, and Psychological Self. Here's what Anatoly Broillard said in Intoxicated by My Illness. My ideal doctor, I can imagine entering my condition, looking around it from the inside like an ideal landlord with a tenant, trying to see what he could make of the premises to make them more livable. He would look around, holding me by the hand, and he would figure what it is like to be me. Then he would try to find certain advantages in the situation. He can turn disadvantages into advantages. He would see the genius of my illness. He would mingle his demon with mine. we would wrestle with my fate together, like Rupert and Birkin in the library in D.H. Lawrence's Women in Love. I would also like a doctor who enjoyed me. I want to be a good story for him, to give him some of my art in exchange for his. This is also fitting very closely with my philosophy of mentor coaching. Here's another example of a voice. And listen to this voice and see what you can tell about this person. My work, my life, is all with the sick, but the sick and their sickness drives me to thoughts which perhaps I might not otherwise have had. So much that I am compelled to ask with Nietzsche, quote, as for sickness, are we not also tempted to ask whether we could get along without it? And to see the questions it raises as fundamental in nature. Constantly my patients drive me to question, and constantly my questions drive patients. Thus, in the stories or studies which follow, there is a continued movement from one to the other. That's Oliver Sacks in The Man Who Mistook His Life, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. And here's one from Annie Dillard. I promise this is the last one. When you write, lay out a line of words. The line of words is a miner's pick, a woodcarver's gouge, a surgeon's probe. You wield it, and it digs a path you follow. Soon you find yourself deep in new territory. Is it a dead end, or have you located the real subject? You'll know tomorrow, or this time next year. You make the path boldly and follow it fearlessly. You go where the path leads. At the end of the path, you find a box canyon. You hammer out reports, dispatch bulletins. That's Annie Dillard's In the Writing Life. So think about voice. I hope I've brought it alive to really let someone know yourself and who you are, what you put into your writing. Barbara McClintock, awarded a Nobel Prize for the study of gene transposition in corn plants, said she made her discoveries by listening to what the corn told her. She said she learned the stories of the plants. She heard them. She watched their daily green journeys of growth and came to know the plants in the way a healer or a mystic would have known them, from the inside, by hearing the inner voices of corn speaking to her as another being. Now, even in my prior life, contributing to the psychoanalytic literature on empathy as a scientific way of listening, it never occurred to me that an ear of corn had much to say. I think she's a genius. I suspect that if I mused out loud to my colleagues that some vegetables were talking to me, they'd be calling the guys in the white coats. For Barbara, it was a true exchange, though. So from the perspective of voice, consider this short passage. I think you'll hear it immediately. And this is important to look at. I want to come back to read another passage of voice if we have time. But I want to move, since we're talking about the craft of writing, to look at designing your book, like creating. You've heard me say before, and you will again, if you really want to change, focus on the system, not just the goal. Everybody has the same goal. Winners and losers have the same goal. Everybody wants to write a book. We're going to talk about how to do it, what's the system. So, first of all, to create a map, design every part of your book. Title. The first five words, tell and sell. We'll come back to why that's important and why the five or less is important. Subtitle is the premise, the benefits described. When you read the subtitle of a book, you get an idea of what you're going to get by reading that book. A silver bullet. consider writing a clear, sharply focused description of your book that can be recited in a very brief paragraph that would explain what your book is about, why it's special, and the benefits that it will provide to readers. A mission statement, a 7 to 9 word statement of the purpose of your book. The back cover, ideally written before you write your book. A compelling ad copy of benefits to the reader. The book introduction, and this is where Grammarly might be considered by you because you want it tight, you want it engaging, and you want it to truly be yours without any kind of stutter step in the flow of it. The problem or the issue you address for your audience, why you wrote the book, the purpose, the benefits, and how you're going to present it. A table of contents, a book outline, and even if you don't use a traditional publishing literary agent and a traditional publishing house, write a query letter and write a nonfiction book proposal. The query letter will help you conceptualize and overview the intended impact of your book. So let's talk about the book proposal. I've included that in your, basically in your outline, but in a little bit more detail in the workbook. So why is this important if you don't plan to submit it to a traditional publishing house? Because the book proposal is the business plan of your book. It's the blueprint of your book, just as certainly as a blueprint is for an architect. You need to know where you're going, goals and strategies. Setting a goal can enhance motivation. Establishing strategies can facilitate focus. If you don't know where you're going, any map will do. So it's important to have the end in mind from the beginning. Lewis Carroll said this really well. Alice came to a fork in the road. Which road do I take, she asked. Where do you want to go, responded the Cheshire Cat. I don't know, Alice answered. Then said the cat, it doesn't matter. Develop an organizing idea with a substantial center. What's your book about? Why does it exist? You'll communicate both of these notions again and again in various ways throughout your book. It's the purpose, the North Star of your book. It's an organizer, and I think is really important. The title, the subtitle, the headline sentences, the chapter subtitles, they all fit the essence of your book, the brand of your book. The nonfiction book proposal is a tool to help you organize and elaborate your concept of a book. And it's an important initial phase of engagement. It may take a significant portion of the time you're planning to write your book. I've talked to authors who have indicated that a fourth to a third of the time they've worked on their nonfiction book has been initially with the book proposal. And you'll see in a moment as we discuss it more, the book proposal has the chapters, the chapter summaries as a blueprint. Another purpose of the proposal can be to tell a publisher about your book, why it's important, why you're the one to write it, why it'll be successful. A good book begins with a good idea. So it needs to address these primary issues. Why would someone want to read your book? Who is your target audience? What is your unique hook? Can the book and the message support, I'm sorry, can the hook and the message support an entire book? And what will I be telling my readers that they don't already know? So let's look at this in terms of the components of the book proposal to help you organize just the concept of the book. One, title and subtitle. The title should contain no more than 5 words. Why, you ask? A longer title requires the reader to think instead of feel. The title should create an instant motivating visualization. We know that more people think in pictures and learn in a visual way, more than 70%, than auditory or kinesthetic. So the title should trigger positive images and emotion, not negative ones. Its focus should be positive, not just the avoidance of a negative. Neuroscience tells us we get what we focus on, not what we want. So the unconscious will read whatever positive or negative as the essential message. So the title should pass the airplane test. Now, that's my personally devised test that came to me when a publisher called to ask me if I would write a blurb for the book jacket of one of his authors. I knew the person, liked his writing. I said, I'm honored that you'd ask. What's the title of the book? And he told me, and I said, I don't know. That doesn't pass the airplane test. And he said, okay, Dave, what's the airplane test? And I said, if I'm on an airplane and someone sees the book I'm reading walking down the aisle, I don't want to be embarrassed by the title or feel stupid for reading it or have somebody wonder if I have whatever that title promises to cure or fix. He said, no, that's not, he thanked me. Had the author change the title, sent me a nice bound galley to review, and it became a bestseller. And there are some exceptions to everything, including this. Here's one exception to the rule of 5 words or less for a title. It's a bestseller by child and adolescent psychologist Dr. Anthony Wolfe. This is the title. Get out of my life, but first would you drop me and Cheryl off at the mall? It's a book, as you might imagine, on adolescent psychology. I won't even bother you with the subtitle. 2, the overview. A compelling overview of your book, 1 or 2 pages in length, should communicate what your book is about and show the essential worth and marketability of a book rather than a story or an article. The overview should be a clear, concise statement that has these 4 elements in some form. What the book is about, why you're writing it, how you're going to write it, and why you are the best person to write it. So think about markets now. This is going to be important, whatever of the 8 or 9 ways that we're going to talk about publishing a bit later. Markets, that's if you, let's say you go to a traditional route and go to a literary agent. They're almost as hard to get as it is to get your book published. This is the first question a literary agent will ask you. What's your platform? That means how many people are following you that are interested in what you have to say who are likely to buy your book. So the markets section should contain information about who will buy your book, who you're writing the book for, why the book should exist, and your strategy and contacts and commitment to selling it. Because no matter how and who you publish, you're going to be the chief salesperson of your book. I thought I lucked into something through the back door to get a book published by McGraw-Hill, Secret Language of Money. First thing they did was lean on me to start marketing months before the book came out to start a blog. And I'll tell you, as that story develops, you're going to need, whether you sell it in at a back table where you present or a traditional publisher or any other way, you're going to be the primary person to market that book. 4, the competition. The competition section spells out, even if you're self-publishing, it helps you think about the results of your research and assessment, the viability of your proposal, the competition, complementary books, competing books, and how you support the idea of the book's existence. 5, promotion. This is the whole gamut of what you will do to promote and sell your book, including with specific points that you'll need to spell out. You remember, the specificity here is regional, national presentations, just to name a few. Publicist, faculty or consultant positions with network promotions, memberships with marketing impact, electronic or regular mail contacts, collaborative promotional affiliate partners, interviews for book release, articles available, interviews given, podcasts, blogs, guest or otherwise, anything you're going to do to promote your book. 6, this is the next in the book proposal, and this is first for you. Remember, it may be only for you, but it's important. The author's background. Capture your background and experience as it relates to the book. And this will help you think about things along the lines of your intended audience. Because you're here's a quick exercise. On a blank sheet of paper, draw a big circle in the middle of the paper. Inside that circle, put a stick figure. That stick figure is your audience. Outside the circle, nobody's going to listen to you. You're going to be another book on a shelf if it gets that far to a brick-and-mortar store, another on Amazon, another shelf. How do you get in that circle? You resonate with the needs, the challenges, the issues of that stick figure, the intended audience. How, with the various contacts you have, electronic, real life, other things, how do you get inside that circle? Once you get inside the circle, then you may be listened to. Now, as you might guess, that's the same circle and stick figure I use in training coaches, that stick figure being your client. How do you get the client to listen to you? It's not about facts and information or data. If somebody has discovered Google, they won't need that. You resonate with the experience of the person to go someplace new with that person and collaboratively proceed. Another, for the book proposal, the sample chapter. That's usually chapter 1, but it simply proves to you and then others that you can do the job. Engage the reader from the first sentence. Look at any book, any nonfiction book that's doing well. You can go to Amazon. You don't have to wait till tomorrow and go to Barnes & Noble. Look at chapter 1, beginning the first sentence. It will begin with a story. A powerful story that engages the reader and begins to capture the essence of the book's message. Now, this nonfiction book proposal can run anywhere from 20 to 40 pages, plus the sample chapter. So it's not just, the proposal is not just a sales tool for the writer. It's an essential teaching tool, an organizer for you, the writer. It's your game plan, your superstructure. This book proposal serves as a map for you because it requires you to understand the meaning of your book and articulate what the book is about. It requires you to think about why you're the person to write it and why anyone would be interested in it. These are the demands you may already be placing on yourself when you've considered writing a book. In fact, the first month or two of creating your book may be about investigating your idea and writing your book proposal. I've summarized the essence of a book proposal in the workbook that you have. If you want to explore a bit more, the two sort of perennial best books for writing a book proposal, and these are readily available and they're regularly updated. One is How to Write a Book Proposal by Michael Larsen, L-A-R-S-E-N, and How to Write the Perfect Book Proposal by Jeff and Deborah Herman, H-E-R-M-A-N-N. So these are just things to consider and think about as you're planning this and beginning to conceptualize the book. So let's look now and jot down any questions. We can come back to this. The 7 Habits of Highly Successful Writers. 1, create a specific plan, including your schedule for writing. Stick with it, no matter what. Sometimes one of the most important things in life, and life as well as writing, is to show up. Now, this schedule, this map, is simply a writing plan that doesn't have to be detailed or burdensome, but it needs to be specific. It may look like some version of this. I will write for 2 hours, 5 days a week, between 8 and 10 p.m. Or I'll draft 500 words of writing each day, 5 days each week. I will create 2 chunks a week. We're going to come back to chunks. I will create the outline of the book by fill in the date. I will create an annotated outline by fill in the date. Notice what we're talking about here is exactly what you learn in coaching. To create a coaching story in a session with a client, you begin with a map. The 2 coordinates of a map, where you are and where you want to go. You ask a client 2 questions at the beginning. What would you like us to focus on? And then once you're both clear, where would you like us to get to by the end of this conversation? So you have a map. A map helps you know where you are, where you're going, how to measure progress along the way. It also tells you what's detour and distraction. And the book proposal is concretizing in a very systematic way your map for that book. And right now we're talking about a different system of structuring the timetable, the schedule for your writing. So focusing on a simple, specific action sets up the best potential for your effectiveness and mastery. So divide up your work. Focus on and complete 1 thing at a time. There's always something you can focus on. Here's an example. During my specialty training in psychiatry, one of my first year supervisors had a really puzzling picture on the wall. It was a photograph that everything seemed, just curiously to me, out of focus. I met with him each week and I'd glance at the photograph until finally, toward the end of the year, it took me that long, I asked him about it. He said, "Well, look carefully, Dave, what do you see?" And I walked over to the photograph to get a closer look. Closer didn't help. It still seemed out of focus. I saw no particular aesthetic value. My experience and considerable interest in photography did not help. And I said, "Steve, the only thing I notice is that there's only 1 branch of 1 tree in focus in the entire picture." He said, "That's why I have it hanging there. It's my reminder that while things may seem confusing and blurry and overwhelming, there's always at least 1 thing you can have in focus and see clearly." That was why he was a great supervisor for first-year residents, when everything looked blurry. 2, when you write, write. Don't combine writing and editing. Writing and editing are 2 different mindsets, 2 different parts of the brain. You can't do both at the same time effectively. You get in a state to write, get grounded and centered, and sustain that state. Plan separate times for each task. 3, take one step at a time. Have a small, specific, definable goal when you sit down. Write in small bursts. The first draft may be done at various times, bit by bit, and may be a compilation of several stacks of pages from various times. Here's an example of one step at a time and a specific focus. Terry Fox started the Marathon of Hope, a cross-Canada run of 3,339 miles. Because he had an artificial leg, his running style was a shuffle and hop. He managed to average 24 miles a day, completed the race in 143 days. He was asked after he finished, had an interview, and was asked, how did you keep going when you were exhausted and you still had thousands of miles ahead? He said, I just kept running to the next telephone pole. Now, he knew that they pointed toward and ended at the conclusion of the Marathon of Hope, but he just did one telephone pole at a time, all the way across Canada. 4, find your most efficient and effective way of writing and stick to it. Whether it's on the computer and you see your words appear on the screen, writing longhand on a yellow pad, or dictating from into a device, whatever it is, see what works the best for you. My style, everything I've written, from complex emails to blogs, white papers, books, has been on a digital dictation device. And I carry that with me basically when I go, when I drive to my ranch, I have that with me. I have a dictation device where I set my office. Everything I've written, I'm envisioning an intended audience and speak to them and just simply turn it off, upload it to idictate.com. They transcribe it for a penny and a quarter a word, and I'm off and running. And it makes it really easy to focus on things. But look at what your style is, what you do best, what fits what your preferred style is. Read your work aloud. This can be an effective element in editing, especially a final edit, a way of listening on another level. If you can, join a writer's group, because most likely that group will have a style of you bring a piece of your writing and someone else reads it. So you don't get to pause right where somebody should pause in reading because you can't determine. It'll be a little bit of a surprise, but it'll be immensely helpful. And we'll return to that. 6, do adequate research. Effective writers know that good research is about pursuing questions and information of yourself as well as books, websites, reports, interviews. One way to do this, and a way that I found immensely useful, to do Google Alerts. And I put in words or phrases that Google Alerts, I have more than a couple of dozen, that a Google Alert, say, putting in quotes, neuroeconomics or behavioral economics, then you're sent every book, article, blog that appears in the world cyberspace on that subject. You'll see the title of the article or the book or the blog, a summary sentence, and then a link to the blog. So an efficient way to do it is if something really grabs your interest, you click on the link, read a couple of sentences, see if it's useful. If it is, then you copy it, stack it up, and read all the things that are related at a time you're in that frame of mind to do that. So it can be very useful. It's also a way when you began publicity pre-book, it's a way that your blog, for example, can go viral. You know, when back to McGraw-Hill, when they nudged me in no uncertain terms to do a blog, I thought that's exactly what the world needs, is one more unedited piece of stuff out there. But I got interested in doing the blog, and I found that with a little bit of search engine optimization, it goes viral. It's picked up by blog search engines. I got clients that way. Mostly, though, it helped me be interested. I began to write a blog that had to do with money psychology, neuroeconomics. I began to read and hear all kinds of things bloggable. So it became a part of repurposing. Between a third and a half of the sequel to that book came from the blogs and the pieces that I wrote due to that nudging and that expanded interest. So here are the top six mistakes successful writers avoid. Now, I told you not to think about the negative, but just check these off and then get back to the positive. Avoid passive sentence construction. Grammarly will help you get started with that. You may not need to do a whole piece with that, but you'll see it. As you reread and edit your work, convert passive verbs into active language whenever possible. Strive to be clear, specific, simple, and humane. Those are the four principles of good writing by William Zinsser in The Art of Writing. It's one of the Bible of writers. Clarity, specificity, simplicity, humanity. Significant work goes into keeping it simple and making it look easy. So keep the burden of the clarity of communication. Don't shift it to the reader or the listener. 3, show, don't tell your audience. Use stories, use metaphors. Combining a good story, right brain, with pointing out the story's lesson, left brain, engages both sides of the brain for balanced learning. People accept ideas more readily when their minds are in story mode as opposed to a more analytical mindset. Show, don't tell. Melville didn't write a story about whaling. He wrote a unique action dialogue drama between one guy and one fish. Stories are how we understand and how we remember. The brain is designed as a story machine. It's how we remember things. James Watson, the guy who with Crick discovered DNA, said, you know, I can remember something when I can fit it into a story. A story is a system for holding together facts. A story makes things make sense. Lawyers know this. Little kids standing next to broken vases know this. There was a study done, if I can recall the specifics. People were given a list of 10 things that they had no idea how they related, and they were asked to remember them. And people remember after given 10 things and a delay with some other things in between to sort of distract their attention, they remembered an average of 4 things out of that list of 10. The other group, given the same list of 10, but they were told that the items that they were going to be hearing, these 10 items, were related somehow to laundry. They remembered 8 out of the 10 things. They had a story to fit it into. So a story makes things make sense. Muriel Rukeyser said, the world is made up of stories, not atoms. 5, keep the eye to a minimum, unless this is really a memoir. To acknowledge and engage your reader, resonate with the reader, not just about you. Now, there are some exceptions, and I may want to take that back as we talk about some various applications. 5, lose the jargon and the fancy phrases. Hemingway believe that 1 to 2 syllable words work better than longer ones. So don't seek or try to impress your audience with your intellect, vocabulary, or research. Your reader wants a savvy friend who explains things in a down-to-earth way, who also happens to be an expert. 6, be a good storyteller. When you carefully craft a talk or tell a story, the art lies in evoking the emotional response from the reader or listener, the empathic resonance with the experience of the listener or reader. Rather than expressing yourself or telling what the reader's reaction should be, you enable the reader to have the emotional experience. We can learn from the poets who offer their art to the reader or listener as a doorway to their own experience. One of the storytellers I studied, I did mentor coaching with, told of an experience he had when he went through an airport in Chicago, O'Hare. A woman stopped him to say how much she enjoyed his presentation 4 years ago and how it had stayed with her. And he asked her to remind him what it was he had talked about that had an impact. And she said, well, I don't really remember what you talked about, but I'll always remember that story you told. So here's a chunking exercise. Here's the Texas version of a chunk. A piece of writing about the size of a newspaper column that looks at a single topic or single subject. So, first exercise, write a single chunk. Have a focus, treat the single subject in a complete self-contained way. This might be an anecdote, a vignette, an exercise, a description of an event, a complete thought, or even a case study. It should be on the subject related to your book. Second exercise, different time period, but still structured, set aside. Write 4 more chunks. You'll begin to see that the chunks are the building blocks of nonfiction books. Third exercise, a different time, a different day. Fit the chunks into your outline. See what the chunks illuminate or describe to further a section of a specific chapter of your book. And exercise 4, plan 1 month of writing. After you've written 5 chunks and fitted them into the outline, you may want to revise your outline. After revision, decide what chunks to write next. And for these, you'll likely be more aware of what you want to write and can make a writing schedule. So here are some important areas of focus for a serious writer. The mission statement of a book. In business, a mission statement is a statement of an organization's primary purpose, the strategies to achieve that purpose, and its fundamental values. A personal mission statement can clarify and give meaning to your daily activities, can add focus and commitment to what you do. So consider the mission statement for your book. A mission statement contains 4 elements: ideals, our core values, purpose, strategies, and goals. There's a little bit more about this in the workbook. So after you create a mission statement for yourself as a writer, think about and revisit it and let it guide you, remind you what you are meant to do. This can become a compass to guide your story to completion and fulfillment. Write it down. Look at it each time before you begin writing. So we're adding here to this idea. First, the mission statement. Second, a business plan for your book, the book proposal. A timetable, a calendar of completion of each segment of your book, a daily and weekly schedule, your writing space, this space of your own, as Virginia Woolf emphasized, your tools, adequate support, whether it's computer, business stationery, digital dictation device, books, references, whatever relates to your writing and furthers your writing and thinking and research. 7, continuing education in writing, in your subject matter, and in marketing. You guys are doing it right now. Consider a writer's group. A huge leap forward that I made came from attending a couple of writer's groups at the University of Iowa. I learned as much from the participants than I did from the writer in each of the groups who coordinate. And that can be really useful, to hear others' work, to read or have read your work out loud, get feedback, and get with a group who is engaged in writing and giving feedback, getting feedback. So here's a kind of a concluding thought. It's about your belief systems. If you want to change your life, as you know, first change your mind. How do you do an inventory of beliefs that may be limiting or compromising? Since 90 to 95% of our operating system is unconscious, the adaptive unconscious. Analogous to impressionistic painting, each of your experiences is a dab of paint on a pointless canvas. Only when you step back and view the entire picture do you recognize that the points form a pattern of a particular segment of life, that the segments have their own unity. You create each experience, the patterns, and the composite image. Each is a different level of awareness. Those of you who have engaged with a mentor coach know the clarity, the development, the catalyst of that collaborative engagement to understand more of yourself, of what works and what doesn't, how to be more effective going forward, and as you've helped others do that as a coach. Remember this, you're always free to change your mind, always free to change your beliefs and core assumptions about who and what you are. I've even had a couple of clients who were just really adamant. They were stuck. I'd like to ask you to do something, to repeat a sentence I'm about to say 3 times out loud and think about it each time. I am always free to change my mind. And by the time they got to the end of the 3rd iteration, they said, wow, that's kind of interesting. Changing your mind not only alters your brain, but transforms your life. First, you have to be aware. Prediction and expectation based on the past create repetition. But based on the present and future, and infused with a little self-reflection, prediction and expectations create possibilities. So a belief system constructs an obstacle or an opportunity. Consider this. What you seek is camouflaged in what you fear. To say that a different way, show me an obstacle and I'll show you a desire. We always create the outside to match the inside. Show me clutter and I'll show you blocked energy that desires release. Now, the secret here is an obstacle is the unconscious mnemonic of desire. It reminds you of what you want, but it makes it safe to want if you're afraid. Here's a story that I think depicts this. I saw a cartoon of a dog straining at its leash, barking ferociously at a cat, as if to say, just let me at it. The next frame showed the cat. The cat was not shabby, at least as ferocious looking, potentially, as the dog, bigger than the dog, looked mean. And then the dog was barking, straining at it. Suddenly, in the middle of a ferocious bark, the leash snapped. So the dog was free to go after the cat. The dog looked astonished, paralyzed, scared to death. He quickly ran back, grabbed the leash, tied a triple knot. Then, could again strain safely at the leash and bark his ferocious, just let me at him. So, the principle here, when you find yourself focusing on the obstacle, I can't find time to work, or I need to get more confident, any kind of limiting belief, reflect on the underlying desire. And here's the coaching principle. When you're ready to consider that you create the obstacle, you're also ready to consider the possibility of not creating it. Imagine what it would be like to not create your obstacles. We're on discussion mode now. If there are questions or comments that you'd like to make, I have another example of voice, but I'm more interested in your thoughts, questions, clarifications. What would be helpful for you? We've got maybe 4 or 5 minutes to talk. What would be helpful to you for us to discuss? Well, let me read one more example of voice. This is from Lewis Thomas. I'm maybe a little partial to physicians. Lewis Thomas, his book, Late Night Thoughts on Listening to Mahler's Ninth Symphony. Here's how he stated. There are some things that human beings can only see out of the corner of the eye. The niftiest examples of this gift familiar to all children are small, faint stars. When you look straight at one such star, it vanishes. When you move your eyes and stare into the space nearby, it reappears. If you pick two faint stars side by side and focus on one of the pair, it disappears, and now you can see the other in the corner of your eye, and you can move your eyes back and forth, turning off the star in the center of your retina and switching to the other one. Something like this happens in music. You can't really hear certain sequences of notes in a Bach fugue, for example, unless at the same time there are other notes being sounded, dominating the feel. The real meaning in music comes from tones only audible in the corner of the mind. Hear how a voice reflects the person and how you get to know the person through the voice in a very directly indirect way. Any thoughts or questions or additions in our last minute or two, or anything you want to highlight for future discussion or inclusion in the discussion? I, again, welcome your emails and feedback and suggestions there if many of you may be listening to the recording. I know I have a dashboard, so I see a number of people here, so I'm very eager to hear from you. Anything you want to add or ask? If not, we will all go quietly into this good night. I really welcome any input and appreciate your attendance and the feedback many of you have already given. So thank you for that. I hope this is hitting the spot and addressing some things that you are really interested in. We'll talk next seminar about the science of writing, especially the neuroscience, and then lastly, the business of writing. Do you want to sell your book, maybe? So we'll pick up right here next time. Thanks very much, and don't hesitate to fire off an email. Thanks so much. Good night. See you guys.